I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It's supposed to be a basic law of economics. The value of a country's currency is supposed to reflect the health of its economy. Look at the U.S. In the past 4 years, the strength of the U.S. economy has gone down, and the value of the dollar has gone down. And in the same 4 years, the strength of the Chinese economy has gone up, but the value of the Chinese currency has stayed down. That's because it's pegged to the U.S. dollar. That is a great deal if you're running a factory in Hangzhou. It allows you to buy and sell goods at a discount. But it seems desperately unfair if you're running a company that's trying to compete in Kendallville, Indiana. As the trade gap between China and the U.S. has grown, pressure has been building in Washington to put an end to what's seen as this subsidy for Chinese businesses. Treasury Secretary John Snow is now saying outright that it's time for the Chinese currency, the yuan, to be disconnected from the dollar so it will rise to a more realistic market level. Well, what do you think? Do you think it would make a difference to unpeg China's currency from the dollar? How far should the U.S. go? Are we talking here about tariffs, shutting the door on China if that's what it takes to protect U.S. jobs? Or is it better to leave the currencies where they are and figure out ways to adapt to a much different and changing U.S. economy? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're starting today with Senator Evan Bayh. He's a Democrat from Indiana who has proposed legislation aimed at stopping what he calls unfair trade subsidies. He's joining us on the line from Washington. Senator, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Dick. Good to be with you.
And I see from the papers that you've been spending a lot of time in the factories and the foundries of Indiana talking with workers about what you can do to help. What is it that they're saying to you, Senator?
Dick, our people, and it's both workers and management, mm-hmm. are concerned that it's just the playing field is not level. They're willing to work hard, think smart, produce quality products, but when the fruits of that hard work and sacrifice are taken away, not because of competitive advantages, but because of artificial financial engineering or because of outright cheating, in the case of the bill you mentioned, illegal subsidies, they think that's just not right, and I agree with them.
I actually saw you using the term premeditated cheating. Is that a way of referring to the artificial difference in the currencies here?
That's one aspect of it, Dick. Yes, the economists estimate that the goods produced in China enjoy anywhere from a 25% to 35% advantage, not because they work harder, not because they think smarter, not because the quality of the products are better, but just because the value of the currency is artificially depressed, below what it would otherwise be if a marketplace set the value. And that's not free trade. That's industrial policy, a violation of free trade. But that's only one aspect. There are documented cases of companies in China getting free electricity, free rent, loans from state-owned banks that they're never intended to repay. You know, you could do pretty well in business if you got most of the inputs for free. So we have cases. You mentioned Kendallville's one. Batesville Tool and Die in my state is another example where the product that they produce, their Chinese competitor sells in this country at one half of a penny above the cost of just the raw materials, leaving nothing for labor, nothing for transport, nothing for electricity, marketing, or any of that. So, I mean, it's physically impossible to do that unless you've got subsidies to bring your cost down. And again, that's not right. So, look, the people in our state, they're willing to compete. They understand that. And as you mentioned, in the preliminary part of your story, we have to be prepared to adjust to a changing global marketplace and do our part. But when we do that, we shouldn't have the fruits of that hard work taken away because other people are getting an unfair advantage through premeditated cheating. That's exactly what it is.
Now, you're among the senators who's at the sort of front edge of a call for unpegging the Chinese currency, getting it disconnected from the dollar. Is it your belief that there's enough momentum in Washington now to actually make this case in powerful terms to the Chinese so they have to listen?
Well, I think that's absolutely right, Dick. There is momentum. It passed out of the Senate by about a 2-1 vote, and there's reason to believe the Chinese are starting to listen. But look, this is all about they're desperately concerned in China about how they take about 140 million excess workers in the agriculture area and move them into the cities and integrate them into the rest of their economy. So everything else, you should look at all of the Chinese economic practices through the prism of stability. They care about stability as they make this transition, and we should want a stable China, but not at the price of unfair instability and dislocation in our own country. Mm-hmm. If it's the result of natural economic competitive forces, that's one thing. But if it's the result of conscious strategy on the part of the Chinese to export their own difficulties here, that's just not right. And I should also say, Dick, we're talking about this in economic terms and financial terms. There's also a national security component here. When we become so heavily indebted to another country, as we currently are today, to the Chinese central bank, that is not a healthy situation. So you saw, you know, a few weeks ago, when the prime minister, in this case of Japan, happened to mention that they would start diversifying out of dollar-denominated assets, it led to a real run on our currency. And a few weeks before that, it was a rumor sweeping through Seoul that the Koreans might do the same thing. So it is not a sign of strength, of security, when comments by foreign officials or rumors in foreign capitals can lead something as important as the value of our currency to decline so rapidly. So this is a major national security issue as well as a financial and economic one.
Senator Bayh, I thank you for being with us to help us start off this program.
My pleasure, Dick. Thank you.
Senator Evan Bayh, Democrat from Indiana. His legislation that he's proposing is called the Stopping Overseas Subsidies Act, and he poses a question that's a good one for the program here. What is the price of stability in China? How much should U.S. workers pay to maintain that stability? Because, of course, big economic trouble in China could cause trouble here as well. It's not all just one way. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's turn to Ted Fishman next. He is author of the recent book China, Inc. He has written extensively about the U.S. trade relationship with China, and he's joining us from the NPR studios in Chicago. Ted, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Dick. Glad to be with you.
Can I ask you to give us a bit of background? I was going to ask for an idiot's guide here, but this whole idea of linking or delinking China's currency to the American dollar, why is it so central to trade between the two countries?
Well, I'm happy to provide an idiot's guide.
Thanks.
The question of currency has everything to do with the ecology in which commerce happens. If the Chinese currency is cheaper than it ought to be, then everything that's produced in China is cheaper than it ought to be when it leaves China and enters the world economy. So if the Chinese currency were to free float and trade like any other good in the world or a share of stock or a bond and find its free market price, and if that free market price were to be 40% higher than the value of the currency is now in dollar terms, then you could think of everything that comes from China and ends up on the store on the shelves of Walmart or ends up in your sock drawer as 40% cheaper than it would be in a free economy. And you know, the Chinese have an industrial policy, as Senator Bayh said, that is very export focused. And because of their export focus, it's in their interest to keep their currency depressed against other world currencies, because that makes their goods much more attractive on the world market. Not only do American manufacturers suffer if their policy is successful in China, but Chinese consumers also suffer because they end up paying 40% more than they want to for all of the goods that they buy that are imported from abroad.
So if the forced lowering of the currency is hard on the consumers in China and it's hard on the workers in America, then is it also a win-win to unpeg the currency and let it go to a market level?
No, it's hardly win-win. You know, we ought to think about this issue in terms of how Americans behave as consumers too, because China is on sale. It's on sale for 40% off. And all of the goods we buy from China are 40% off. We have a $170 billion trade deficit with China last year. It might go to close to a quarter of a trillion dollars this year. That means a quarter of a trillion dollars in goods is coming into America at 40% off. And for each American consumer, this saves an enormous amount of money. Last year, it saved about $550 for every single American. That's about two times the amount of money returned to Americans in the Bush tax cut. And, of course, the Bush tax cut caused us to deficit spend. The China savings doesn't cost us anything.
Yeah, one of the points that you were talking about with one of my colleagues here at the program is that when China then starts exporting larger items to the United States, like automobiles, for example, then that savings, if it continues, could be the death of GM and Ford, right?
Well, think about the DVD player. When the Chinese entered the DVD market to create DVD players, the price of DVD players dropped 98%. 98%. You can buy them for under $25 now. That's the price of a movie. So it made a very high ticket item into an impulse item. And I'm wondering whether we're going to see the day, one day soon, in which cars are impulse items in the aisles of Costco or outside, parked outside Walmart, where you'll get a pretty good car for about $6,000.
So if someone in Washington were to say to you, Ted, should we do it? Should we unpeg the currency? Is there a short answer to that you would give them?
I would give them the short answer, which is we ought to do what we can to get the currencies decoupled, but not use tariffs. Tariffs are a far too important weapon to use in our trade picture, and we have much bigger issues with China. So we have to keep our ammo dry, keep those tariffs for far bigger issues that we face with China.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. If you had a pipeline straight to Washington, what would your advice be? Is it time to disconnect the two currencies, let the Chinese yuan float on the market, or is there a benefit to the U.S. consumer by keeping those linked together? Is that benefit of considerable value to you? Because basically what you're doing is, on one hand, you're looking at the cost in U.S. jobs, and on the other hand, what it is that you can save by having China as a deep discount exporter for this country. Anyway, it's much in the news right now. A lot of pressure on China to let its currency float. Time to hear from you on this. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. It is getting close to decision time for the Chinese as pressure builds internationally for them to de-link their currency with the U.S. dollar. And there are significant implications for people in this country. So we'd like to hear from you at 1-800-423-8255. Ted Fishman is with us. He's the author of a book called China Inc. He is a former currency trader and works as a contributing editor to Harper's Magazine, The New York Times Magazine, and others. We're bringing Peter Marici into the conversation now. Peter's an economist and business professor at the University of Maryland, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Peter, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
I gather you have no hesitation about this at all. You say the currencies must be delinked at almost any cost.
I think they do need to be delinked. Now, I would say that it doesn't have to be done at the cost of stability. For example, we could repeg the currency by 20% immediately and then lower it in tranches of 5 or 10% every 3 to 6 months until we found a currency value that cleared the market, and then periodically reevaluate the currency. That's the first thing.
Now, you said we could, but ultimately this is a decision that's going to be made by the central bank in China, right?
True, although we only have to continue to trade with China on these terms as long as we choose to. That is, we do have the option of imposing a tariff, and I would suggest that this is too far and important an issue for us not to consider doing that. I would also point out that these goods, or these discounts that we receive, this 33% subsidy is not free. In order to get it, the Chinese buy U.S. dollars, which they convert to Treasury securities, and basically hold in the vaults in Beijing or in a trust account at the Federal Reserve. Sometimes the bonds don't even leave the country. And we have to pay interest on that money, and the interest that we pay grows each year. We are amassing an enormous debt to China to do this. So basically, we're living high on the hog now and shifting the debt to our children. And this is very different than the national debt, so to speak, that we owe to ourselves. This is a real liability. The other thing is that stability in China means instability in Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, and places like that. There are a goodly number of American manufacturers that are highly competitive. I've done a lot of work on this. Mm-hmm. And my analysis indicates that in the metal fabricating industry, for example, U.S. industry is very competitive. Productivity growth has been very high, and we should not be losing those kinds of activities to China the way we are, say, T-shirts and coffee tables and toys and so forth. That this is a very unfortunate situation for those people, and if you think that we're getting those goods for free, then go talk to an unemployed factory worker in Indiana and ask him how free it is.
Yeah, in fact, we have, and I know exactly how angry some of the people are there. Ted Fishman, just the other side of the looking glass, though, on using something as heavy-handed as a tariff to force the Chinese to raise the level of their currency. I mean, in part, the U.S., the health of the U.S. economy depends on a healthy China. So is there a risk of hitting them too hard and hammering ourselves at the same time?
The equation is so complex, Dick, and there are so many angles to it. I agree with Professor Marici, and I admire his work. And an adjustment that we might all live with is an incremental adjustment, and the Chinese might be happy to offer that too, because it would help them out. The Chinese pay for raw materials around the world in dollars. If their currency appreciated, the cost of oil, the cost of metals, and other precious materials would go down relatively for them, and that could fuel their boom mm-hmm. even more. And if there's one thing that's going to push it beyond tariffs, push the Chinese to act without us imposing tariffs, it's going to be the cost of these raw materials. And they do need some relief on them because wages there, of course, are a small fraction of what they are in the United States. And the Chinese do need energy to fuel their businesses and their households. And so tariffs might not be necessary. You can only roll out the tariff weapon so many times before you really get anathematized as a country. And we have big issues with China that are just as important to the competitiveness of any worker in Indiana, Wisconsin, or anywhere else in this country. And part of it has to do with the mismatch of our kinds of economy that we have with China. China has a making things economy. The United States has a making ideas economy. We sell goods that transfer very easily by email attachment and other electronic means. Where the rest of the world sells China machines to run its factories, we sell China software and patented and trademark goods that run their machines and run their idea economy. But we don't get paid for that. And if we're going to use tariffs anyway, it ought to be to protect the kind of economy we have. And we right now have no rules to protect our knowledge economy, and that might be the battle that we ought to choose instead of the
currency.
Okay,
we're going to take
battle.
That a little bit further, but we have a number of people who want to join us on the phone, so we should go there next. Beverly, Massachusetts. Jay's on the line. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Dick.
What do you think?
My question was covered with the last comment, but about the jobs in Indiana. But I'd like to try to modify it a little bit then and say, you know, we talk about incremental changes to the Chinese economy and how they're going to change how they peg their currency to us. Why can't we incrementally put a tax subsidy I'm sorry if I'm a little tongue-tied, but why can't we help the guys out in Indiana that are sheet metal workers and give a tax break to those people who are employing Americans and spending their money here and not sending it overseas?
Peter Marici, is this part of now what's being discussed in Washington?
Well, the notion of a tariff is being discussed in Washington. I have to say the Bush administration has been very reluctant to even call this manipulation on the part of the Chinese what it is, and that is currency manipulation, or to recognize its impact on manufacturing. I like to say the Bush administration is blind to fact and deaf to reason on this subject. It has come along very, very reluctantly, and this is why the Chinese, in my mind, are so reluctant to move. They view the Congress as making a lot of noise, but in the end, the Bush administration is very ambivalent about doing anything whatsoever to solve the problem other than have talks. And the Chinese are willing to talk to us for all eternity if we care to. One of the things we could do would be to impose a 20% tariff on Chinese goods and indicate that we'll raise that tariff by 10% every 3 months until the problem is resolved. And in turn, as the Chinese revalue their currency, we'll remove it. I can think of no more issue more important to the vitality of the high-tech economy than the trade deficit. Industries that export or that compete with imports undertake far more R&D than other industries in the economy. And by having this deficit with China and other Asian economies that follow its lead and manipulate their currencies as well, it significantly reduces the amount of research and development taking place in the U.S. economy. By my estimates, it reduces the attainable rate of growth in the U.S. economy by 1%. When this nonsense began, looking closer, not so abstractly, looking closer, when this nonsense began in 1999 and 2000, we got unemployment down to 3.8%. Now it's 5.2%. The U.S. economy, if it was operating again at 4% unemployment, we didn't have this trade deficit, would be substantially larger.
Let me, if I can, bring Mark Headley in at this point. Mark's president of the Matthews International Capital Matthews International Capital Management, and more to the point, portfolio manager of one of the largest equity funds investing in China. He's been listening on the phone. Mark, it's good of you to join us.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
The words currency manipulation. I know you spent a lot of time talking with Chinese executives. Would they agree there's a certain amount of currency manipulation going on here?
Well, I think manipulation is an interesting word. I mean, every country in the world has some sort of currency regime in place, and so the fact is they put their current price levels in when the U.S. dollar was very strong back in 1995 and rode a strong dollar for many years. It's really been the deterioration of U.S. fiscal deficits and it's not really China's fault that Americans don't know how to spend, but it's always easy to blame somebody else. And I think that's a lot of what's going on with this. China doesn't have an operating financial system. They can't have a free-floating currency. That's just off the table.
Okay, but whose fault is that if after 10 years of banging along at 10% growth, they say, gee, we still don't have a banking system that works.
Well,
we need yours.
And I'd say that's true. They are desperately trying to reform their banking system because they know very well from the Asian financial crisis back in 97 that it was weak banking systems that destroyed Thailand, destroyed Indonesia, you know, practically burdened these economies to the ground, and they're desperately trying to avoid that problem. And reforming their banking system is absolutely their key priority, and I think their biggest risk case going forward, that we have a financial collapse in China. It's a very real risk, and China is not just some behemoth rolling forward. It's a very challenging, dangerous experiment, and the Chinese are brutally aware of that fact.
And when you're talking with them, how afraid are these Chinese executives, how afraid are the Chinese politicians of unpredictability, of instability? I mean, all those things that almost naturally come along with freeing up of a currency and sort of throwing your fortune to the winds of the market.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, you've got to look back at Chinese history, and they've had so many collapses, so many disasters, so many, you know, just horrible things in the last 100 years. I mean, Mao was just the last horrible disaster to occur to the country. And they are terrified of another challenge. And obviously, being a communist party that's running a capitalist economy is a little uncomfortable to begin with. So all they can really run on is, you know, two chickens in every pot, and someday you'll get a Honda Accord. I think that it's very difficult for them. And the 97 crisis, they were actually talking a lot about doing things on the currency before the 97 crisis. And when that hit, it really set back their thinking and made them very conservative. So I do think they want to move forward to a more flexible currency policy, but they are far more concerned about instability in their domestic economy than they are about the pressure they're receiving from the outside. That is starting to tilt. As the pressure grows, it is starting to tilt. There's no doubt about it.
Mark, one quick one before I let you go, and that is a question about speculation. We've been reading in the last few days that a lot of people are anticipating a change in the level of the Chinese currency and looking desperately for any way to try and capitalize on that. Is that going on right now?
It's going on. I mean, you see people buying apartments like crazy in Shanghai because it's one of the few ways you can actually go in and buy local currency assets. And so there are pockets of speculation, and there have been people trying to find a way to bet on this for the last 5 years, and mostly I think it's come to naught. But there's a little sense that something's happening this time. We're seeing hints from the Chinese that they are, you know, going to try to do something. I think it's going to end up being not a big deal, but maybe some effort to revalue the currency modestly in a very controlled fashion.
Mark, thanks for your time.
Oh, my pleasure.
Mark's president of Matthews International Capital Management. It's one of the largest equity funds buying stocks and bonds in China and Taiwan. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. I'm wondering if I can just get a quick word, Ted Fishman, from you on this Chinese fear of instability and how much the U.S. and other countries need to factor that into their relations with this country.
It's such an essential point, and Mark Headley was right on the money. You know, asking China to free float its currency might be a perfect case of regretting what you wish for. Because of the backdrop of instability, the Chinese themselves, their government aside, are fantastic personal portfolio managers. And by that I mean they like to diversify their assets. And if the currencies were to float and the Chinese were allowed to play the currency markets on their own in more concrete ways than they can now, you may find that the Chinese public runs to dollars as a safe haven. The Chinese themselves on an individual basis liken dollars to gold. And it is a very significant thing for them to have in their own families. And that is one reason why Chinese send family members abroad, so they can live in a dollar economy. And if we were to free float the currency, you may not see the Chinese currency appreciate much at all. You may see it decline. And if China were to have a banking collapse, you might see it decline quite a bit, in which case China would go more deeply on sale.
Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina for a call from Marcos, who's been holding on the line. Hi, Marcos.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good.
Good. 2 points, 2 questions. One is the whole question of China's currency. I mean, there's an issue of sovereignty there that I'm sure the Chinese are well aware of. And just like I think it was Mark had mentioned, every country in the world, including us, has used currency monetary policy to its advantage, including our own Federal Reserve.
Sure.
How would we feel if we have someone trying to advise us how to set monetary policy with an enormous amount of pressure? But the second point, and I think a more important one, is why so focused? We're intensely focused on China. And, you know, I talk to people and I tell them stuff like, for example, we import far substantially more from Canada, even up to 2004. Chinese goods from China, you can say, well, Chinese goods are made with cheap labor and the cost of labor there is rising, but it's made with cheap labor. But if you recall the parallel to Japan in the 1980s, where we were terrified about Japan this, Japan that, Japan the threat, and, well, that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. And it just, my question, one of my questions is, why are we so focused on China? And if Japan, and like
let me put that to Peter Marici. Is that sort of concentration, that focus on China, irrational, Peter, or is it accurate?
No, it's quite rational. We do import a lot from Canada, but we also sell a lot there. Our trade is much less out of balance with Canada than it is with China. We have about a $700 billion deficit on goods and services. About half of that is caused by currency manipulation. Last year, for the latest data we have, there was $350 billion of U.S. currency purchases. That's half the trade deficit. China was responsible for $205 billion of that. The rest were countries that had to follow its lead, mostly in Asia, lest they lose their markets in the United States to China. We're not talking about sovereignty. What we're talking about is playing by the rules of the game in the global marketplace. For example, we're all signatures of the IMF agreements, and they indicate that currency shouldn't be used in this way. Likewise, the WTO agreements. We're talking about playing by the rules of the game, which China is not doing.
Okay, but wait a second here. When I read about this in The Economist magazine or in The Wall Street Journal, I see the sort of hard-edged economists there saying, and if the U.S. turns protectionist over this, the U.S. will not be playing by the rules. It's going to be breaking, you know, the WTO rules of the game.
There is the issue of whether we're breaking the rules of the game or not. However, I would suggest to you that sitting idly while another man punches you in the nose is a foolish thing. I shouldn't punch you in the nose, but what should I do if you punch me in the nose first? With regard to stability, no one is advocating pulling the slats out and floating China's yuan tomorrow. What we're talking about is a process of bringing it into adjustment. With regard to its banks, you have the banking problem where the yuan is pegged at 8.38 or at 5. At 5, trade would balance. We'd still have the banking issue. China has $600 billion in U.S. dollars on reserve. That's more than adequate to restructure the loans and the portfolios of its banks. The banking problem comes down to a bad loans problem. The real question is who then manages the banks? The Chinese don't have the kind of expertise that Western countries do. Are they really willing to permit Western participation in their banking system at the level necessary to assure sound banking practices? I think those are the kinds of questions this really turns on, and that's Chinese protectionism.
Connection listeners, who is really in charge here? Is it going to be up to the U.S. Senate to tell the Chinese central bank that in order to continue relations with the U.S., it is simply going to have to let its currency float somewhere closer to market level? Or are the Chinese now so well dug in and insinuated into every level of the American economy that they're in the driver's seat? What do you want the people in Washington to be doing as we look at the number of U.S. jobs that continue to be threatened by the Chinese manufacturing sector? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection, and we're talking about the difference between the U.S. dollar and the Chinese yuan on this program. The Chinese yuan continues to be pegged to the dollar, and that's a terrific financial advantage to manufacturers and exporters in China. Just exactly how much muscle should the U.S., U.S. politicians, apply to this problem? What's the upside? What's the downside? Peter Marici is with us from the NPR studios in Washington. He's a professor at the School of Business at the University of Maryland and has been an outspoken advocate of getting the yuan to float freely against the dollar. Ted Fishman is author of China Inc. He's joining us from studios in Chicago. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Rutland, Massachusetts for a call from James. James, thanks for calling.
Well, thank you.
What do you think?
Well, I think that when I was a young man, and American industrial manufacturing was 60% of the world industrial output, I think we were in control. But given today that we're probably at 8 or 10% of the world's industrial output, we're sort of a player in a game with a lot of other players now. And if we marginalize ourselves even more by putting tariffs on our economy, then we will be marginalized even more. I think the only option is to simply jump in the game and produce more in America.
But I mean, if you've got American workers who are making $9 an hour and Chinese workers who are being paid 50 cents an hour, how do you compete even if the currencies are floating freely, James?
Well, it's not so much the hourly wage
yeah.
that's the hang-up for American business and industry expansion. I'm firmly convinced that it's the overhead cost and in regulations that people in business are forced to participate in this country, where in China they're not. They don't pay into many government programs in China where American industry is forced to pay into.
So why not use tariffs to try and balance that out, James?
Well, because we don't have the leverage anymore. We're 200 million people working, and you're talking about a global economy with is we're just one of 20 where we used to be quite dominant. We no longer have the capacity to leverage their behavior.
Ted Fishman, is James right when he talks about it this way?
Well, I would agree with him in one fundamental way, which is that the currency issue really overlooks the true cost advantage that Chinese manufacturers have. They have a systematic cost advantage which is independent from the level of their currency. The first statement to make there is that it's an open question what would happen to the currency if it floated. The second is that Chinese labor is about 1/40th the price of American labor. Even top talent, engineers and scientists, work for a tenth or a sixth of what Americans do. And you can't get the Chinese to raise their currency by 600%. So willing away that cost advantage with tariffs to enforce a currency change is wishful thinking for American manufacturers. Another really important fact that people ought to realize is that because Americans have lost manufacturing jobs doesn't mean that American manufacturing itself is suffering. Output from American factories in the last 4 years is actually up, even though 3 million people have been turned away from the factory doors. And that's because workers are getting replaced with machines. So when people bemoan the fate of the American worker, they ought to be measuring it against what their own factories are doing to replace those workers, not the fact that the factories are closing. In fact, American industrial output is up.
Peter, what do you make of the of Ted's answer to James here that you know, just the change in currency might not make the difference, and neither would tariffs?
Well, there are some industries in which we would not be competitive even with a change in currency. However, there are others where we would be because of the much higher productivity of American industry and the much larger knowledge content that he likes to talk about.
Give me an example of what you're talking about. Are we talking about cars here or computers? We're not talking about T-shirts.
We're talking about automobiles have an enormous knowledge content. If we weren't facing this currency disadvantage and China removed its tariffs on cars, it would pay to send cars there rather than make them there. It certainly would not pay to outsource components for American-assembled cars at the upper level, components that go into engines and things like that, and General Motors is pushing its suppliers to do that. The bottom line is some industries are gone, never coming back. Others shouldn't leave. If we readjust the currency, they won't. The currency is nothing but a price. An exchange rate is a price. And to say the exchange rate doesn't matter is to say that prices don't matter. At the beginning of this program, Ted did indicate that if the currency were adjusted by 40%, Chinese goods would become more expensive by 40%. That's only an average. Some would be less, some would be more. Those that would be more, those would likely be made here again.
No one's saying currencies don't matter. I think that's a simplification of what I'm saying. What I'm saying is it's an open question what would happen if the currency were allowed to float. And identifying the currency as the prime problem understates the great advantages on costs that the Chinese have systematically throughout their system.
Are you saying, Ted, that if the currency was, if the Chinese currency was delinked from the American dollar, that it would not necessarily automatically go up 20, 30, 40%?
Well, I spent 9 years in the currency pitch at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. The one thing I learned from that experience is there's no predicting which way currencies will go. And there was an Asian Asian economic collapse in 1997. China might suffer the same, and that would not bode well for the Chinese currency. In other words, it would drop against the dollar if they had a bank collapse. And just as it happened in the Asian financial collapse, goods out of China, just like goods out of Southeast Asia in 1997, would get cheaper, not more expensive.
Peter, what about that? What about the idea that raising the cost of the currency could, in fact, end up hurting this country?
In the short term, a lot of hot money could leave China, and that could actually lower the value of its currency. Once that happened, though, then the more fundamental aspects of the trading relationship would take over. Its cost advantages in manufacturing and so forth would have an impact on the currency value. The fact that it attracts a lot of investment would have an impact as well in the other direction. One must distinguish between a period of adjustment after a market has been highly constrained and people haven't been able to adjust their assets as they would like, and the longer term value of the currency. And here I'm not talking about years from now, I'm talking about several months. Mm. The potential for such instability and panic is why I don't advocate floating the currency immediately. I advocate adjusting it in steps. And until we get to the point where we balance out the financial flows so that the supply of yuan offered in the global market is equal to the demand and the supply of dollars offered is equal to the demand as well. To say that there would be a period of instability after the market has been constrained 10 years is a reason to keep constraining the market. You know, by that reasoning, we ought to set all the prices and fix them all, whether it's bananas, wheat, cars, or exchange rates.
Let's go back to our callers, to Lexington, Kentucky. Ed's joining us on the line from there. Ed, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I think there are several factors here besides the currency. I think, one, we're destroying our manufacturing base in America, and I think that's bad because I think we overestimate the ability of the American worker to all be knowledge and intellectual workers. I've been to China many times, and their workforce is just as intelligent and just as industrious as ours. Secondly, I think this huge trade imbalance means that basically they're buying up our country. We are going to become a nation of sharecroppers working on farms that somebody else owns or plants that somebody else owns.
But if the two economies are so dependent on each other, as I think they are at this point, Ed, what do you do to avoid that happening, your scenario?
Well, I don't think we fully realize the barriers to us trading in China. We can't go in there with virtually anything. So we talk about we shouldn't put tariffs here, but they have all kinds of barriers and artificial resistances to input from other countries. We talk about the value of our intellectual capital, which they totally discount. They steal our CDs. They steal our movies. They take our technology out of our plants. I think we need to be a little more realistic about this, and it's beyond just the currency. It's a whole understanding of what we need to be a country long term. And I think if we give away...
I'm not disagreeing with you, but I do want you to try and bring this to us. So what does the U.S. do to enforce what you're saying here?
What the U.S. does is do exactly what China does in reverse. We act for the good of our country and not just for our opinions of what it takes to be a leader in the world.
Ted Fishman, what would happen?
What would happen is if we use tariffs to get the rules we need for world trade that would benefit us, we would probably get those rules pretty quickly. We just have to identify which of the rules are important to us. I don't think the currency is a place where we can get the result that we need. But I agree with the caller that if we do enforce rules on intellectual property, that would return to the American economy tens of billions, perhaps hundreds of billions of dollars in lost sales. And it would also protect these small and medium-sized manufacturers throughout the United States for whom many of which have only some patented product as their prime asset.
But how do you enforce those rules of intellectual property without using the tariff club that Peter's talking about?
I'm talking about using the tariff club. Okay. Not for currency, but for intellectual property. It's a far more essential issue, and it's far more important for the long-term health of our economy.
1-800-423-8255. Where are we off to next? To Syracuse, New York. And Peter's with us. Hi, Peter.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Hey, my question really is the one element that we fail to look at is today, if you go back 100 years, tariffs were really used to protect both workers and manufacturers. But now we have a lot of multinational companies, and it's really to their benefit, and these are American companies, to really do their manufacturing over in China. This is the one gentleman talked about earlier about GM forcing all their suppliers to go to China.
Right.
You know, and it's kind of like, first of all, I would de-link the currency almost immediately, but there has to be some type of, you know, looking at, you know, I don't think it's going to happen with the Congress controlled the way it is by big corporations. I think it's time to, you know, start protecting not only we got to look at the worker, not just a corporation.
And I mean, it is another aspect where it's a little bit more complicated than it might appear on face value. I'm going to hear from both my guests on here, and Ted Fishman to start with. From you, I mean, the Fortune 500 companies aren't as worried about this as the small and medium-sized companies that Peter is talking about, right?
No, the Fortune 500 companies love China's currency regime. It's those companies that are trying to move all of their supply chains as fast as they possibly can to China to take advantage of this 40% discount. And in so doing, they are pulling the rug out from under the rest of American industry. Now, whether they're really getting the 40% discount is something that I'm challenging. But they do get the advantage of this vast low-cost economy, and that does come at the cost of America's small and medium-sized businesses who are not as nimble and cannot get to China as fast.
So, Peter, put this in Washington terms. For me, I mean, I would have to think that the Fortune 500 executives are just as important a part of the Cheney Bush audience as the smaller businesses represented by senators from across the country. Are they getting a conflicting message now?
Well, I would have to say that some of the Fortune 500 companies are multinational companies like General Motors who are not acting in the national interest. They're acting in their own interest.
Hear, hear.
Once a company invests in protection, for example, General Motors has factories in Brazil to make cars there because there's a 25% tariff, then removing that tariff, as good as it may be for the global economy, is bad for General Motors. So it then becomes invested in Brazilian protectionism. Huh. General Motors now has an investment in Chinese protectionism and is trying to victimize its suppliers. Let me explain. It produces in China for the market there. If the currency is gradually revalued, it still has that market because it's there already. However, if it persuades a maker of engine components to move to China to supply its factories in the U.S. and the currency gets changed, that firm is left high and dry. So basically, General Motors is getting the benefits and forcing the risks on its suppliers. General Motors is not behaving like an American company these days.
Here's an interesting fact. The American companies that supply Japanese automakers making cars in the United States do not have any of the problems that they face when they deal with General Motors and Ford. The Japanese are very loyal to their American suppliers, and American auto parts makers much prefer doing business with Japanese automakers in the United States because they are stable.
So what's the lesson from that?
The lesson is that we have to think about what it means to be an American company. Increasingly, what it means to be a large global American company is that you work against the industrial interests of your own country.
Let's go back to Peter in Syracuse. Is this the way you're looking at it as well?
And that pretty much summarizes it, because if you look at the multinationals, they're in their own interests, and they seem to forget about Americans. who really were their beginnings, where they started from. You know, it's been the American economy that gave them the position, the ability to get to where they are today. And the sad part of it, from my perspective, owning a small business, we have no voice in what goes on in Congress or the Senate, but these multinational companies do. They control the money, they control everything, so I guess we're kind of stuck with what we're stuck with.
Well, you heard Senator Evan Bayh at the very beginning of the program, Peter, saying that there are, in fact, politicians from across the country who are trying to get this thing moving. Do you not think that they're going to be successful?
My opinion is no. Until we get the money out of politics, it's not going to, as long as there's back doors for corporations to supply money into politics the way they do today, nothing's going to change, which is sad.
Peter Marici, you've been pushing for this delinking of currencies for years now. Do you think that we are actually closer to it than we've been before?
I think that we're close to the Chinese doing something. The question is whether it's something nominal like 5%, or they really take the path. The technocrats in China favor moving, you know, the bureaucrats. Mm-hmm. The Communist Party, no, because the Communist Party is really an anachronism now in a capitalist economy, and it greatly fears instability. It doesn't trust markets and is greatly resistive of what the Americans might recommend for cultural as well as economic reasons. So I think we're going to get some movement, but it's not going to be enough. Until the Bush administration starts to identify its political interests with common working people, I doubt that we are going to get the kind of change we need, because I don't think the Chinese are getting the kind of signal that we need to send from Bush and Snow.
And they'll just go as slow as they possibly can until that signal comes, Ted?
You know, I think it's very important to look at the current currency debate and what Secretary Snow is saying. To me, this is a signal that medium and small-sized businesses in the country has found their voice. I may not agree with their immediate solution, but I think it's a wonderful development that this voice is rising. It's pushing of the interests beyond those of the Fortune 500, and I think this will continue. It's a kind of grassroots movement which is essential for our country and for us to get consensus on China.
Ted, thanks for being with us on the program today.
Thank you.
Ted Fishman, author of China, Inc. And Peter Marici, thank you for your time as well.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Peter's a professor of business at the University of Maryland. Earlier in the program, we talked with Mark Headley, who's president of Matthews International Capital Management, and Senator Evan Bayh, a Democrat from Indiana. The Connection is produced by Sarah Baker, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.